number 11744, rule 4.
They thought he couldn't run fast enough if he had hammer toes, but he was operated on and he went there. And by the same token, he came with us to do the Rhine crossing. Went through a lot with him, and we actually went into Belsen together on VE Day, but that's another story. By the same strange coincidence, while I was at North Weald, I had an airman on my watch called Ron Ashton. Political family, came from Bishop Stortford Way, somewhere in that end of the world. He came to me on one night watch and said, "I'm liable to be posted overseas at any time. My wife is due to have a baby within 4 months. I'd like to be home to see that before I go." So I said, "Well, the obvious thing to do is to apply for a commission. You've got all the qualifications. Good bloke, you know, which he did, and he was duly posted for his officer training and became an officer. Forgot what happened to him. One always does, doesn't one, after that sort of thing? Until I went across for the Rhine crossing for this Type 70 set. And
this was a centimetric.
Yes. This Type 77 centimetric set. And I arrived in a town in Holland in bitter cold weather, ice, snow, frozen down about 2 foot into the ground, and I took 12 three-ton lorries in there and met my CO. It was Ron Ashton, Wing Commander Ashton, same chap. Never happens, does it? By the same token, at North Weald, I had a lovely waff, and I heard she got married. After I became a teacher, my first job was up in North London, and I had a very fine headmaster who was an arrant snob and who hated his wife, and he used to have lodgers at his house because he couldn't talk to his wife, but he could talk to strangers. And he brought the lodgers along to school one day because he was intensely proud of the fact that one of them was a baronet. And he turned up, and it was Sir Michael Bruce Bart. He was an ex-trainer of glider pilots that I knew vaguely because he was shot down just the other side of the Rhine. But I knew his wife incredibly well because she was one of the WAFs on my watch. I nearly got drummed out of that school because I knew him better than the head did. But by the same token, at Debden, we'd had a bad run. One does at times. And we'd lost a lot of aircraft. It was before the Americans came there, but that's another thing. I won't natter on about them and their Thunderbolts. And one night, we'd lost a fair number of bombers, and the morning sweep of Spitfires over the Dutch Islands saw a dirty great bomber dinghy 12 miles off the Dutch Islands. And whether the Germans were sitting there and waiting for us to send an air sea rescue boat over or not, I don't know. But got hold of the Admiralty, worked out drifts and winds and tides and God knows what else. And we got permission from the Air Ministry to send off two of our tame amphibians, you know, the shagbats, what do you call them, walruses. Out to pick them up, and we were allowed 2 minutes over the target to look for them, pick them up, and so on. So we worked out carefully how to sort of courses, speeds, and all the other things. And I went on duty that evening and found to my horror that the bloke who'd worked them out had worked out speeds in miles per hour. And in those days, hurricanes and stuff were miles per hour, and shagbats were in knots. I don't know why, it just happens. So we altered the courses and whatnot a bit sharpish. We sent them off at last light. On the way out there, we had two air sea rescue Spits, and one of them shot down 190. It's impossible, you know, but he did it. The two walruses soldiered on across the North Sea in this semi-darkness. We tried to send the Navy out with high-speed launches to do backup for them, and then we lost radio contact with them. So we sent over some mosquitoes, guessing where they'd be, and doing a sort of very wide figure of eight and stuff too, so that the Germans wouldn't be able to pinpoint them, and trying to lead the Navy boats towards our. In the end, they picked them up within, I think, half a minute or so of our estimated time. Sheer unadulterated luck. There was nothing else. One of the shag bats got off the sea and flew back. The other one taxied back with its engine getting steadily red hot. We still played covering them up with mosquitoes and things. But one of the pilots in that particular air-sea rescue flight, one of the Spitfire pilots, not the one who shot down 190, was a bloke called Leslie Vickery. Let me get to the Rhine crossing and I'll tell you a bit more about Leslie Vickery.
Yes.
At any rate, we had a lot of fun at Malvern. We had our sets. We had our marquee. Now, we found that if we had a big enough marquee, we could put two lorries parallel with each other inside the marquee, which would act as offices, chart rooms, map rooms, all the other things that we wanted. We could put a large plotting table on the centre of the marquee. In other words, it was a full-sized operations room. On the far end, we had clever screens that were lit from the side, you know, Perspex screens, that we could plot fighters and things on. Why, I don't know. Sheer show, because you've dealt with a thing like that.
Right, you
know,
totally.
Yes. You know, that's what you plotted things on and off. You had a chap sitting beside you with a chart table and his course and speed calculator, his Dalton, or whatever you like to call it, which is another form of, I don't need to tell you, form of course and speed calculator, and a way to calculate heights if you know how to do it, not accurately. But as you climb, you know, your pitot head, the air doesn't lean on it quite so heavily, does it? So that if you've got an indicated of 180, let's say, at about 15,000 feet, you're actually doing about 400 miles an hour. You can imagine that, can't you?
Yeah.
Whereas with a Dalton or a old-fashioned course and speed calculator, you can work out what the speed over the ground is. I'm teaching you to suck eggs, I don't
That's
mean
all right.
to. Now, you've got your two large three-ton trucks stuck in there for your chart rooms and things. At 90 degrees to them, you had two other large, old Crosley trucks with windows in the side and four lots of plotting screens, plus four lots of chart tables, plus all the odd army bodies and the chief controller, the deputy controllers, the old Uncle Tom Cobley and all, you can imagine. Now, we practiced putting it up and down once or twice and we tried it. If you remember, I told you that the old-fashioned way of finding heights was to work on the lobes that you were produced by this strange formula, twice height over the wavelength. Now, because we'd gone centimetric, we could use a bow fire affair, that swept round, instead of a chicken run aerial, or the aerial looked as if it was covered in chicken run, and you could lock it on, or you could chase around and find your target with your rotating aerial. You found your height by finding your aerial. Do you remember? You looked for your bearing, you looked for your range, and you had a thing called a nodding neddy, which was rather like a fairground swing boat with a dipole in the centre. You then lined that up with your target. And remember, your target can either be friendly or hostile. And from your nodding neddy, you got a dead accurate height. None of this nonsense about lobes. You just pointed it at it, and you had a line going direct to the target. So, in the fullness of time, we loaded all this lot up under a series of freighters and left Tilbury docks. On the way there, I was driving one of these enormous Crosleys, great square-fronted things. Even with my size, I looked like a mahout on an elephant, you know. And when I used to work for my living, I was a cost clerk in an engineering works in Euston Road. And I was nipping past my own firm when a laddie, an idiot that he was, in a little Austin 7 van cut across the bows of my Thornycroft. I kicked the brakes like a fool, and of course, icy roads and snow and all the rest of it, I slid gracefully into him with a nice healthy clang. Now, it did no harm to my truck, you can imagine it, but it didn't improve his Austin 7 van at all. But it made a noise. And as I got out to talk to him and sort of try and push him out of the way, because I wasn't going to stop and argue the toss, the window opened up there, and there was our company secretary hanging on and said, "What the devil are they letting you loose in a lorry for? Knew you'd wreck something anyway." Sheer luck, you know, that I should have gone past when he was busy looking at me. But at any rate, we got over to Erp. Marvellous place. We do a place called Erp, E-R-P, in Holland. It's south of Arnhem. Doesn't matter. It's a little tiny village it was then. It's grown since. Last time I went on a car rally in those parts, we stopped at Erp because it was the only place in my combined-ups career where we'd had 6 weeks with nobody even spraining an ankle, getting hurt or anything else. Nice to see the place again. It's grown enormously. But we then did the Rhine crossing and went into Germany and up through the Reichswald. Now, before we actually did the crossing, we were controlling at Erp. And we saw a 262 come over, and we tried to catch it with Griffin engine spit, and we couldn't. Well, obviously, the thing went up like a rocket. While I was busy controlling somebody over the towards the Rhine, but north of that, we got a jet mixed up with this lot, and all I could do was to bellow to the formation, "For God's sake, look out, there's a jet on it, so there's a squirt on its way. See if you can take evasive action." You know, there's nothing I could do, or nothing that they could do for that matter. It was my old mate Les Vickery got shot down by that one, and he vanished into somewhere towards Denmark and that part of the world, sat in a ditch for a long time with people looking for him, and came home. Now,
did you see many German jets?
No, they were the only pair that I saw. Don't forget, we spend our time indoors, the troglodytes, that's us, you know it. A very quiet existence, ours. The next time I ran across Leslie Vickery, I'd become head of an educationally subnormal school in Eltham. Now, I got the job, God knows why, because I knew nothing about educationally subnormal kids. If you want an expert on blind children, on partially sighted children, or things like that, I'm your man. But it was too close to home to throw away. So I got the damn job, I don't know how. But I thought I'd better find the next school to me that carried ESN children, ring them up and say I'm coming over to see what I've got to do with them. And I rang Rose Cottage, which was Leslie Vickery's school, and said, "Oi, tell me something about it." And he swore like a trooper. He said, "You're bloody Kenway, aren't you?" So I said, "No, my name's Wright." He said, "No, your call sign was Kenway. You're the bugger that had me shot down." And it was. And I was. That was the first time I met him since then. As I say, it's sheer fluke. All of these things are utter coincidence and quite boring for you. But poor bloke, he's one of the few really fit people I ever knew. About 7 years ago, he was still the same weight as when he flew, and he walked like mad and all sorts of things like that, and had a fast heart attack and was dead before he hit his own carpet. And on Friday we were off at his old school planting a tree in memory of him. But
you said things. This time you went into Belsen, did you?
Yes. But don't forget, we nipped up through the Reichswald and went up for Hamburg. Oh, generally sort of potted our way up towards Denmark. Did a lot of damage as we went. Most awful memory is when the three-tonner carrying all the lavatory buckets hit a tree. And for weeks after that, everybody was rushing about with little trenching tools in the nearest spot of scrubland. Life was very uncomfortable. But we finished the war. Where was the damn peacetime? Where did peace break out?
Lüneburg
Heath. Yes, we were at the airfield at Lüneburg. And the padre came along, a magnificent bloke, and said, "Belsen's 40 miles down there. Let's take some lorries and go down there." So we took some lorries and went down there. Didn't do much about it. We merely tried to clear the place up. Now, I flew. I'd done several invasions. I'd been chased about by various unpleasant people. The only thing that ever stopped me from getting drunk or from sleeping was Belsen. Driving a 3-ton Chevrolet truck towards it, you could smell it 2 miles away over the smell of your engine. Stunk of burning leather and burning bodies. We were all covered in DDT, given some spare shirts, and then said, "Over there are some huts. As you go towards those huts, if you see any bodies, put them in the back of your truck and put them out over beside the huts."
Did you?
We did, in a big way. You'd walk along there, you'd see a chap in his pyjama suit sort of tottering down the path towards you, dusty paths. You'd go and do something, unload some gear or put some bodies beside the truck, and they were put into great open graves that were dug by bulldozer things. And you'd find him dead beside the road and you'd take him and put him in there. I have a nasty feeling that several other camp staff went into the same graves.
What made you think that?
When I drove the camp doctor to cell for a military prison. And I'm a rotten dream. He must have fallen over several times on the way there. He was a bit battered when he got there. Nasty man. Syphilitic ex-medical student. His hobby was seeing how long people would live if he injected them with milk or tar or petrol. No, an entirely unpleasant character. We tidied the place up. We cleaned these huts. You'd take as many people out and put them into one hut as you could. You disinfect, you clean, you'd scrub one hut. You move the people back into that one. Then you'd start on the next one. We acquired a few German helpers from the local village who knew nothing about Belsen, so they told us, but the local inhabitants said that they went along there and tossed food over the top, rather like going to the zoo to watch the monkeys fight, you know. We took children out. Combined Ops Unit have a vast amount of chocolate and sweets given them, you can imagine. So we collected all the chocolate, all the sweets that we could. And we used to go down three to a three-tonner. Chap drove down there and he nipped in to give a blood transfusion. The chap in the front seat used to go on the back with about 30 or 40 kids. And the chap who's on the back nipped up in the front and drove, you see. You take them off to the nearest woods or field or something. Give them a football to play with and you showed them what to do. You gave them a piece of chocolate. And you know the little square of Cadbury's, do you?
Yes.
You flick it on your tooth like that. It lasted them for an hour or so. It was something out of heaven. But poor little devils, sort of, the first time we did it, they lined up against the trees and waited for us to shoot them. There was one poor little girl dying of TB, and she wanted to see a lamb. And I went off with a padre to find one. Have you ever tried to chase a lamb across a field and no. catch it? By God, you need to be fast. We finally got one and found, brought it into her, and she was tickled pink. It was so springy and so hard.
But they felt that you were going to shoot them.
Oh, all the kids did, yes. Well, we still carried our pistols and our rifles and things, and that's what happened to most of them, you see. And why should we be different from the other mob that came in there? The Russians came and pinched all their people. It was a most unpleasant place. As I say, we worked there for a little while. Then we went back to get some more petrol and some more clothes and went back in again, and then we went in regularly. And the Air Force were a bit cross with us because, I mean, you don't go around stealing Air Force lorries officially, you know. It's not a good thing. But I remember once when they burnt the hutted part of it, because just up the road was a most beautiful SS barracks. Marble-faced and beautiful, baths, everything you want. We slowly shunted people into that would live, you see. But when we came to burn down the huts, we had a sort of ceremony, and there was going to be a concert that night, because the people who lived in Belsen were not the great, solid, strong navvy types. They were the people who were solicitors, musicians, actors, people with enough brain power to know there must be a future somewhere. And one of the favourite tricks of this prison doctor was to put a pianist's hands on his desk and thump them with a rifle butt, you see, which didn't improve their chances of playing much afterwards. And you get kids who come up to you and say, what a pity you weren't here last week. My father was alive then. At any rate, we had this magnificent concert given by the inmates. And on the way there, our padre, who was a terrific bloke, chap called Nye, said, good God, we're going to a concert. We haven't got any bouquets for the artists. And I think there are about three sergeants and this squadron leader bloke. And we stopped at every patch of flowers we could find, and we were busy wrapping up bundles of flowers to give to the artists. The other nasty thing, the thing that saved most people, we managed to acquire a lot of blankets from one of the ships in Hamburg. And we got hold of the Americans, and they flew in mirrors, little hand mirrors, you know, the sort of thing you keep in a hand, not you, but one keeps in a handbag. Lipsticks and combs, and they kept more people alive than ever penicillin did.
Because it improved their morale.
Oh, yes. The other thing was that we killed a lot of people in the early days because we gave them whatever food we got. And they woofed it and promptly died, you know. So we didn't do things like that. And we had a business where they fed them on soil-link paste, porridge affair, little pots of it, rather about the size of those teapots, with a dob of bovary stuff, beet extract, in the centre of it. And we had these people sitting at great long tables in one of the buildings. And we said, come on, eat this. And they looked at us and reckoned we were poisoning them. You know, I don't blame them. It was horrible looking stuff. So we spent quite a long time going round from table to table. We'd pick up one of these and eat it ourselves and say, go on, eat it. And then we'd find another one.
How soon after its liberation did you get into Belsen, do you think?
10 days, I suppose. I was in there on VE Day. And the army were in there before us. I should say about 10 days. It was close-ish, you know. Not the sort of thing that one does for fun.
This German doctor, what was his name that you mentioned?
Oh, goodness knows. I rather dissociated myself from Germans for quite a time after that. You know, I have no profound objection to killing people or in the way of business being killed because, as I was saying at the beginning, it's part of the thing you pay for having a jolly good time, in effect, and lots of comfort. But as we went through the Reichswald and that part of the world and went through the north of Holland and into Germany, beside the railway lines, you'd find graves, and there's masses of them, little tiny ones. And we began to get a bit worried, and they were people being carted off to concentration camps and lobbed over and sort of planted because they'd have been a health hazard otherwise. And Belsen put me right off because that was for highly disciplined and organized people like the Germans. That was an appalling thing to do, just to let people die unnecessarily and to kill them. And all right, if they wanted to kill them, then kill them, but don't just let them starve or... I'm sorry, I'm being nasty about it, but... And as far as the names went, I wouldn't even flog German cigarettes. I didn't like them enough to even join in with their rotten black market. Not a coincidence. A particular friend of mine, he was a headmaster when I was head of his upper school, and then he became a headmaster over at Plumstead, where I knew him well. He is the chap who actually won the war, and he's extremely proud of it. He was in airborne intelligence, and outside Calm, he went forward to get a prisoner and ask him who his mother was, you know, and the usual things that they ask them. And he got shot. And they carted him back to England for hospital. And Kahn collapsed and everything collapsed and we got through to the Rhine. And old John never did learn very well. They patched him up and he went forward to Reichswald or somewhere like that. And he tried the same thing again and got shot and Germany collapsed and Japan gave up. So old John won the war. He's extremely proud of it. But I seem to have been wickering on for a long time.
You were just about to tell me about people fleeing to...